Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here with Giddy Khalsa. I got coached on how to say that. So once you all see the spelling, just think of salsa. That's how I did it. Did I do it right?
You got it, man. You nailed it.
Anyways, for those who are into the music scene of the 90s and early 2000s, and maybe I'll even get corrected, maybe it's even a wider range than that, you may have heard Giddy on the drums with 7 Mary 3. James, who is behind the scenes here, he recognized Giddy right away and was anxious for this interview. So, but however, what's fascinating, this is why I'm anxious to get into this. The last 15 years, Giddy has been advising clients, in my words, on the rhythm of their financial lives. And currently today is president of Pace Wealth Advisors. I'm assuming that name means something, so we'll probably get into that. But so excited for our listeners to hear your story. I know we had lunch the other day, and I think we chatted for, I don't know, hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, and I don't think either one of us breathed. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm delighted and honored to be here. And Jeff, I have to tell you, frankly, I feel like I'm out of my element. I listened to the podcast with Bob Dahl, and I was joking with a friend as I was driving over. I was like, man, this isn't like a little local, you know, like these are some serious people that you guys have had. So I feel, you know, I'm like, I'm in a Wayne's World episode right now where I'm not worthy, you know?
No, you're worthy. And I think, you know, when we went to lunch, what's so fascinating about you, I mean, there's obviously so many angles and layers to you, but I'm going to throw out some stereotypes. You don't picture a musician, at least I don't, all of a sudden in the financial world. And so in my mind, you almost kind of turn things upside down. Obviously, you have the analytical skill in that, but I'm fascinated to see how your creativity and how that comes into play. So with that in mind, I'm actually going to go completely flip how I normally have these interviews.
Yeah. But
let's start at the end and go, because you've had some amazing experiences. If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, as drummers, I always, you kind of need to know where you're going, right? When you're leading the band. So, you always have these questions about song structure and where's the, you know, when does the verse end and the chorus begin and so on and so forth. And what I love about this question is actually, I think there's a question within a question is, can we actually make dreams come true? Because my experience has really been one of a dream being cultivated. And the reason I say that is, you know, in my mind, if sort of you can make something happen, like subconsciously we have dreams, right? Mm-hmm. Like our dreams happen in our sleep. We don't cause them to happen. They just happen. You know, in my mind, if you have the ability to make something come true, then I don't know that I'd call that a dream, right? I think it's different than that. That feels a little manufactured. My experience, and so, you know, and this is why I think, yeah, beginning with the end in mind is useful, right? Because so the origin story, if you will, the cultivation, if you will, begins with my parents immigrating to the U.S. in the late 60s.
Okay.
So my dad came before my mom. He chose, of all places, the University of Mississippi, so Ole Miss.
That's a hotbed for immigrants.
It was one thing to be Indian coming to the Ole Miss campus in the late 60s. It was another to be Sikh. Huh. So my family, you know, hail from India and we're Sikhs. And so my dad wears a turban, my brother wears a turban, my uncles and, you know, well, aunts, the ladies don't wear them. So, you know, there's a long tradition in our family of faith. And specifically being Sikh, and I suspect maybe some listeners will know a little bit about Sikhism. But Sikhism emerged in India in the late sort of 1400s as a response to Islam being spread a bit violently, I guess. And so the Sikhs really emerged as sort of a warrior tradition, if you will. And I think the reason I share that is that, you know, my dad, at the end of the day, in choosing of all places, Ole Miss, you know, he was a fighter and he wasn't afraid of a challenge. And so I think in general terms, I would say, maybe this is a bit of a stereotype, but, you know, Indians are hardworking people. Mm. Sikhs in particular are very disciplined. They take pride in working hard and being focused. And I know that for me, especially initially growing up in the Deep South, but then we sort of migrated to the Mid-Atlantic. And so my formative years really were growing up in Northern Virginia, in the D.C. suburbs.
Okay.
And, you know, my dad always said to me, look, you know, we're a minority. You have to work hard. You wear a turban, you have to work even harder. And so it was ingrained in me, you know, from a very young age. Hey, yeah, you're different. You look different. People are going to make fun of you. They think you have a sock on your head, you know?
Can I laugh at that?
Absolutely.
Okay,
you
right,
know what
right.
I mean? Like, I got called Haji. I got, you know, there were all kinds of, you know, thankfully Johnny Quest was a cool show.
Oh, I love Johnny Quest.
Right? You know, and the interesting thing is, so I think for me, being Sikh really forced me, whether I liked it or not, to come to grips with identity, right? At a very young age. I mean, when you look different, you know, it's one thing to have different skin color, but it's, you know, it's another when it's really visible, you know?
Yeah.
So I had these questions from a very young age. Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to look this way? What does this mean? Why is this important? You know, for most of my youth, it was fine. You know, I'd say by the, so really, I think the seminal crossroads, if you will, was as a young boy from birth to, you know, 10 or 11, I was, my identity was being Sikh, whether I liked it or not.
Okay.
You know, at 10, I was at the bus stop and there was a kid with a Kiss lunchbox and that changed my world, right? I saw on his lunchbox this, what is that? Who are those guys? You know, you've got this Gene Simmons with blood all over his face. And I'm like, whoa, okay, these guys have, clearly this is a rock and roll band, but they've created their identity, you know?
By the way, this is the first time we've ever had the band Kiss come up in come our up podcast. In a, yeah. I love it.
So you know, anyway, so for me, the crossroads was that, so, you know, at age 10, I'm in the fourth grade, there was a assembly in elementary school. The music teacher introduced all these different instruments. And as soon as he got to the drums, you know, that was it. I was like, that's for me.
Do you know why?
Well, they were just cooler than the other instruments, you know, right? If you look at the other band instruments, you know, no disrespect to my friends who play trumpet and clarinet and so on and so forth. But, you know, let's be honest. I mean, trumpet and saxophone are about as close as you can get, right?
But well, in fifth, sixth grade, I was known to tickle the saxophone keys, whatever you call
there
them.
There you go. There you go.
And I've got about three songs. Peter Gunn, dun dun dun.
Oh
dun,
yeah,
dun,
man.
Dun, dun,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But you would have been the cool guy. I mean, I always wanted drums. My parents would never let me because like it was just ruckus.
Yeah. And so, you know, so the first element of this, like I said, you know, so the discipline piece was very interesting. So I'm introduced to the, and it's not, I would like to say I'm introduced to the drums, but really, you know, in fourth grade, you're introduced to a drum. And so it's pretty boring. And so for the first probably month, frankly, I was like, oh man, this is not nearly as cool as what I thought it would be, you know, compared to listening to Kiss albums in my parents' basement. And jumping off of, you know, the furniture like I was, you know, in the band or whatever. So I remember after about a month, I asked my dad, I'm like, hey, Dad, I think I want to switch to guitar. You know, my parents, I mean, we were upper middle class, but, you know, my parents were not wealthy, especially at this point in life. And so we were renting my drum. You know, my dad said, well, hey, we'll rent this. We'll see how you like it. And if it's something you stick with, we'll buy it. You know, so my dad said, well, I tell you what, let's wait till the end of the month. And if you're still not into it, we'll get you a guitar. And the very next week, I happened to learn a rock beat at school, and that was it.
That was it.
And that was the beginning and the end, really, frankly. And it's amazing because as I reflect back on that really seminal moment, had my dad said, yeah, fine, let's just go trade it in, right? So him pressing in and simply saying, yeah, let's just give it a couple more weeks, see what happens, you know? And so there again, is that cultivating or is it making, right? Because I think that was, there was a mindset thing of, I'm not sure what's around the next corner, but I know that maybe if we just wait a couple of weeks, something will happen.
So, and I'm assuming now that we talked to, this is not a hard assumption, if we were to get some 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds who are in a band, I imagine that question for them would be, I'd love to make it big in a band.
Sure.
So in one regard, you've lived probably what most people would call a dream. how would you respond to that 18-year-old who says that's a dream of theirs?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, certainly one I've been asked. Yeah. So I think there's a line, right, where at first you have this dream. And yeah, it's absolutely playing in front of 100,000 people and all those things. And so that's fueling you when you're in the basement. You're, mm-hmm. you know, you are filling your head with these visions of mm-hmm. grandeur. Most people, I think, are. You know, as you mature, the interesting thing is, so there's the excitement that happens when you get together with a group of friends in the basement and the very first time, like, the guitars get plugged in and you start hitting the drums and it's totally chaotic and it probably sounds terrible, but it's really exciting because you feel like you're in control of right. something, right? It's the genesis of the creative thing, you know? Initially, there's that excitement, but it's connected to this bigger dream. And so for me, the journey was interesting, and I'll bring it back around to the, you know, the 18-year-old. My formative years were spent playing in every kind of musical situation I could, whether it was jazz band, marching band, you know, chorus, anything I could do to play, I was playing, including playing in rock and roll bands with friends. And so that was really sort of how I was seeing the world, if you will.
Got it.
And all the way through high school. Interestingly, it was, I think for most young people, it happens either in the arts or in sports, mm-hmm. where you experience that thing that says, you know, if I put my mind to it and I work really hard and I take some of my maybe God-given talent and I apply mm-hmm. working hard, then good things happen. And so for me, that happened through music. And ultimately, it was around my junior, senior year where the things I was doing musically led me to feel that if I apply this energy, no matter where I apply it, I'll be successful. Growing up, most Indians, it's sort of you become an engineer, you become a doctor, or you own a 7-Eleven. That's changed. I'll keep going with the stereotypes. I'm allowed to do it. Now it's IT, right? Now it's you're in Silicon Valley. But anyway, I kid mostly. For me, I really did not want to be a doctor for during my adolescence. I really wanted to be a musician. And so ironically, it was through music towards the end of my high school years that I realized, hey, if I work hard, I could be a doctor. I could, you know, that's what my dad was. And so I decided towards the end of high school that as much as I love music, I was going to focus on medicine.
Okay.
And so ironically, I began college and really ended college with the intent of going to medical school. And it wasn't until I graduated, I went to William & Mary up in Virginia, and my bandmates, we came together, we met through some mutual friends, started playing together. And from the very first time we played together, it's like, all right, screw med school. I'm doing the rock and roll thing.
And why, do you know why that magic was there?
Yeah, just because the song, I mean, our singer had a real vision. He had a great voice, but he wrote from a very authentic place, and I connected with it. And I think the nature of being a drummer, right? Drummers, there's a reason you don't see drummers in coffee shops by themselves, right? Like, we're meant to be part of something. We're not the singer-songwriter. So I don't know that I knew it in quite so poetic terms back then, but I was really comfortable and enjoyed being a supporting member of something.
Uh-huh.
I liked being part of the team, if you will. And so as a drummer, I got to make a meaningful contribution and drive the proverbial bus, but it wasn't my vision, right? It was just finding someone who had one and saying, I want to be part of that.
I'm going to plead my ignorance when it comes to music because I want to hear from a professional. So you're in a band, you're the drummer. What's the role of a drummer in a band?
It really depends on the kind of music. And so I'll simplify it and keep it in the realm of rock, and I'll keep it in the realm of more traditional rock and not a band like Rush. So there's math rock, and then there's, you know, Led Zeppelin, John Bonham playing with tremendous feel rock. And that was more, I think, where I was coming from, not to put myself on the level of John Bonham. But I think ultimately a drummer's purpose is to be the foundation, is to be the bedrock, and to serve the music, right? And so for me, it was creating space. It was about obviously setting time and tempo, mm-hmm. but really more than anything, creating space so that other things could happen, allowing music to breathe, if you will. And I think I got to be pretty good at that, at least by the end of our career. But yeah, it's setting the tempo. And so that means you need to have a sense of direction. You need to have a sense of where are we going and what's going to feel right and how to hold a band together. Yeah, I think at its core, it's to be the pulse.
So I don't want to stretch this too far, but in your new role, I shouldn't say new role, you've been doing this for 15 plus years. Yeah. Can you leverage that skill set?
Absolutely. So I think the thread there, so just to give the listeners kind of some context, because most of the time I think when people say, well, how did you go from playing in a rock and roll band to being a financial advisor?
Well, that's a natural transition.
Right? Yeah, it's it makes perfect sense. So, I mean, I can count to four really well, you know, so there's that. So for me, I was very fortunate to be in a band where we had some commercial success early on, and I started investing. It was the mid-90s. It was a great time for the capital markets. You could basically throw a dart at a tech stock and make money. So it was a great introduction to the markets. At the same time, being in the music business meant that, you know, with the relative level of success we had, where we're having, we were meeting presidents and heads of companies like Time Warner and Disney and so on and so forth. So we were dealing with executives and understanding the kinds of metrics that executives use to measure success. And whether that's amount of records sold back in that day, right? Mm-hmm. Streaming today, whether it's radio play and where you are on the charts, those kinds of things. I guess, you know, one of the things I know we'll talk about is capital, mm-hmm. right? And so at the end of the day, there's different kinds of capital, and we were introduced, I guess. That was our introduction to how capital works in the entertainment business. Mm. And that might be relationships. It might be quality of songs. It's a variety of different things. So that introduction, I think, got me on the path of saying, I'm really interested in how things work. You can break that down to a song and what makes a great song, whether it's a really beautiful, simple melody and a decent rhythm and a great lyric to accompany it, or whether it's a business, right? Mm. A product that people can understand and quote unquote resonates with an audience. So I started to see how these relationships between what I was doing in music and entertainment just related to the world more broadly. After, you know, almost 13 years of playing in the band, we'd made 6 albums together. It had been a wonderful journey. And I was reaching the point where I was in my mid-30s wanting to settle down. I hadn't gotten married yet. Two of the four of us were married. And I was starting to think about, okay, is this the chapter? Is this a really big chapter or is it a book? And I decided it's a really fat chapter with some great stories, but ultimately it's not the whole kit and caboodle. And so as I started to think about my other interests, I kept coming back, you know, to this interest in business, generally speaking. And a lot of my friends at that time had gone on to go to business schools like Wharton and Harvard and so on and so forth. And one of my friends who was an entrepreneur, he said, you know, Giddy, yeah, you could go get an MBA from one of those programs, but I think you've effectively already gotten an MBA by being in the music business and experienced the things that you have. Maybe you just need to go start something and just go do something. One of my friends, a good friend, neighbor, mentor, was a hedge fund manager. He knew I had an interest in finance. And I said, hey, I'm just, you know, am I too old to make this transition? He said, oh, you're finally getting a few gray hairs. You know, people might actually listen to you. You know, he really helped shepherd me and sort of introduce me to the world of finance and the different fields that were available. And once I sort of stumbled onto wealth management, which I really didn't know anything about, I'd been investing, but I didn't know there was a field for it. I mean, I knew what stockbrokers were,
right?
I didn't understand what a financial advisor was. I saw that there were athletes who'd made that transition, but there was no one that I'd ever come across that had been on the entertainment side. And certainly, you know, without sounding, you know, braggadocious, I guess, but there were no platinum selling artists working for Wall Street firms. And so I thought, okay, maybe there's an angle here. And then I just started talking to some of my friends in other bands and said, you know, hey, if I were to do this, would you consider working with me? And you know, at least one said yes. And so, you know, and that's really how it began. And so the interesting thing for me, the journey has been one of recognizing that as an artist, ideally, if you're successful and you're lucky, you create a legacy through your work.
Right.
I think for me, the bridge was as a financial advisor, here we are back in the realm of capital, and ultimately the really good and fun and deep questions are, okay, what are your values and what kind of story are you going to try to tell with what you've built? Maybe it's a little hokey, I don't know, but to me, actually, it's there's a lot that's, they're more similar than one might think. Whether it's building a song, whether it's building a story, whether it's building a life, right? Whether it's building a legacy, I think they're actually quite related. And so, you know, and that was not when I initially got into it. I'd be kidding if I said that's
sure
that's how I was thinking. Right. But and then I think the real heart of it and why I ultimately decided to create my own firm last year with Pace is that if you looked at my lifestyle as a musician, if you looked at how I was, so I believe this, if you want to know what someone values, look at how they spend time, look at how they spend money, right? So if you saw where my capital was going and if you saw where my time and energy were going, you would say, man, Giddy's priorities are definitely not that of a person who's looking to get married and have kids, you know, in my mid-30s, when I made the career transition, it was also at a crossroads where I'd met someone who I wanted to spend my life with, and she already had a daughter. So I was sort of instantly in the realm of, okay, I'm not only getting married, but I have a child. And so my priorities immediately shifted. And so now here I am working in a profession where I have to really come to terms with my own issues of, man, do I behave in line with what I profess to value? And where's that disconnect, you know? And so that frankly was a difficult process on some level, but on one I was ready for and I think I welcomed, right? Because at the end of the day, I didn't want to be a hypocrite. I didn't want to, I didn't want to be the doctor who smoked cigarettes, right? Yeah. And so really it was a wonderful opportunity. And I came across a quote the other day that says, you know, if you want to be really great at something, teach it and teach the things where you're maybe not always your strongest. You know, I don't know that I want to have a surgeon operate on me who's just learning, but my point is, I think the journey that I had to go through as an individual and as an investor was one that ultimately I said, you know, I would like to take what I've learned from this journey and help other people.
Man, I could go a number of different ways here. Just a couple of comments. I love, and I'm going to put this in my own words, but I love how obviously you had the left brain, you know, be counting numeric side, you've been investing. But what I love is, and I probably wouldn't have said this to you 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have agreed with it, but I wouldn't have believed it. But now, in my words, you're bringing in the art of investing.
Yeah.
You're bringing in planning is not just numerical. It's so much deeper than that. And so to hear the way that you're fusing your musical experience as well as everything that came around that from the business side, I think is, I would love to interview some of your clients to see how that influences the way you work with them versus maybe a traditional Wall Street advisor. But let me jump to this next question is, so you obviously had a phenomenal music career. By all measures, you have a successful financial advisory business. How would you best describe yourself in the context of where you are in your journey?
That's a good one.
It's a minor question.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And there were a couple of threads that come to mind in the previous question. And so I'm going to weave these together as best as I can. So there was a pretty cool moment early in our career where I think discipline combined with having a vision can be pretty powerful when you have a sense of purpose. Because I think my issue, and this actually relates on a spiritual level, and I think some of the challenges and frustrations I had growing up Sikh, is that it's a very works-oriented faith, as many faith traditions tend to be. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, except that you can get so focused on the work that you lose sight of what's the work for. Christian faith is interesting because it's a relational faith. And without going down the path of, you know, talking too much about faith, it is relevant. It is important. All of that is to say that when you have a sense of purpose and you combine discipline with it, I think it can be pretty meaningful. At the same time, and I think this is where my perhaps empathic listening skills as a musician come in handy, is that, you know, there's the great illustration. You file a flight plan when you're trying to get from point A to point B, but if you don't make course corrections, you might crash into the Rockies. Planning by its nature requires having a sense of a destination, but you have to know how to adjust, right? And being a good drummer, being a good musician in general, playing with other people is all about adapting and adjusting. There's a chance I'll have a client listening to this podcast, so I'm going to actually throw myself under the bus because last week, and this is what I love about the profession. So last week I was having a conversation with a relatively new client and I was listening to her, but I wasn't hearing her. And we got to a point of frustration and, you know, it took a couple of hours of reflection to come to terms and recognize, hey, I did a couple things wrong there. I wasn't my best. And while I was probably claiming to be a pretty good listener, right, I don't know that I was hearing that person. The other quality that's so important is humility and recognizing that, hey, there are going to be times when we need to adjust our pace or adjust the rhythm to make things work, right? And sometimes in music, as a drummer and our singer, I know would agree with this. There were so many times when I think I would drive him crazy because like I was hell bent on holding a particular tempo and I would force and he would, I could feel him staring at me, you know, through the back of his head, you know, like, dude, let's adjust here a little bit, right? And there's often, I think, sometimes a battle between drummers and singers or drummers and guitar players and fighting for where the right tempo is or where the right feel is. You know, if you think about pacing, there's three choices. You either force the person that you're playing with to come to you, you go to them, or you find a new middle ground, right? And that's so much of life. That's so much of, it's definitely a part of child rearing, I've learned. And it's definitely a part of marriage. And so when do you flex? How do you flex? What does that look like? Can you do it joyfully, right? These are the fundamental questions. And I think where that kind of came to a head for me is, you know, I've had the great fortune of being both a performer and an audience member. And that's, I think, informed the way I look at the world and how I look at business, because early in our career, you know, we went to go see Pearl Jam, which was one of our favorite bands at the time. And I'll never forget it. They were playing down in Tampa, a big arena show. It was their third record. And what I noticed was that when they weren't playing one of their plethora of hits off the first two records, the people around us were just kind of talking and, you know, not as into it as I might have imagined. And I remember thinking, well, crap, if this is what they're doing for Pearl Jam, what are they doing for us?
Wow.
Right? And it was a reminder, you know, the nice thing about being a drummer is, you know, because you're sitting, you can kind of look around a little bit, right? It never was lost on me that, yeah, the people in the first five rows are going nuts and they're having a great time and maybe hanging on to every word. But the people in the back, you know, they want to hear Cumbersome and Water's Edge and then they're going to go get a beer. And so, you know, whether it's just being a drummer and being a supporting member, whether it's, you know, having the at least the experience of saying, hey, I've been in the audience and I know what it looks like. I think that's informed how I think about things and just having, you know, having a bit of a broader perspective, if you will.
In your work today or in your family or whatever, how are you trying to change the world?
Again, great question. And I'll bring it back to the relationship between my career as an artist and where I am today. When I'd finally hit that point, that crossroads of, okay, what's next? I remember, and we've talked about some mutual friends before. I know during your CNL days, you worked with Paul Doucette from Matchbox 20, his mom. And so I remember actually Paul and I having a really great conversation after we'd finished our sixth record. And it was a record we were really proud of. And he said, man, this is a great record. I can't believe you're going to leave the band now. You know, what if this record blows up? And I said, What if it blows up? What will we experience that's different than we already have? The reason I think that's relevant is that for me, I had an opportunity. I don't know that 7 Mary 3 changed the world, but we certainly had our 15 minutes of relative success and a taste of what it looks like. I'm reading Dave Grohl's book and it's fun to read. He's a great writer and storyteller. You know, I've been on the side of being in front of 20, 30, even 100,000 people and what it feels like to put my hands up in the air and put the sticks up in the air and people go crazy. And it's pretty cool. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's electrifying. But the problem and the challenge is I think this is true for all people in the spotlight, if you will, is that it's kind of a one-sided dynamic. It's a one-sided relationship, right? So the audience member feels like they know you, but you don't know them. So somebody comes up and they tells you, hey, you know, this song got me through a really dark period in my life. While on the one hand, that feels cool. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, I don't know you. I'm not your friend, you know? And ultimately it starts to feel a little bit hollow. And I think for a lot of people, I think the danger is you feed off of that. You need that. You need that fix. I need people to know that I matter. I need people to know that I'm making a difference in their world. When the reality is, maybe I am, but it's a one-sided relationship. And so what I found in my current path and what I love about being a financial advisor, you know, I like to say, I'm a financial advisor, but ultimately I like to say I'm a lifestyle guide, you know, and I want to guide people on a path that's sustainable and in line with what they value and what's important to them, which means by the very nature of that, I need to know them on an intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. Ideally, I know them well. And ideally, I know what makes them tick. And ideally, I know what really excites them and brings them joy. And I also ideally know what they're afraid of. If I'm fortunate, maybe we can weave that into how we think about their resources and what their legacy is going to look like and what it means to steward, you know, during whatever life we have here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you take us into stewardship. What does stewardship either mean to you and or stewardship when you're talking to your clients?
Yeah. I take it back to this idea of cultivating and what it means to build something. Because, you know, coming from an immigrant mindset, if you will, certainly what I saw in my parents generationally is the desire to create or build or do something for the next generation that if you're lucky, you get to see, but you might not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it's very interesting because when I think about what legacy means and when I think about what stewarding means, woven into that is, again, these questions of what do you really value and how much of that is tied to ego and a need for knowing, hey, I made the difference. Right. Because what if you don't get to see it? It was pretty interesting. A few weeks ago, I was walking my daughter. One of my daughters plays soccer, and I dropped her off at soccer practice, and I was just going for a walk and run and listening to some podcasts and music and running around Winter Park. Right now, I'm a one-man show. It's a new firm. It's me. I have a larger firm supporting me called Mariner Platform Solutions, so it's not like I'm by myself, and I have the resources of Schwab and Fidelity sure. and such. So, you know, it's great. But it's a new endeavor. And it was a little scary, frankly, leaving Morgan Stanley, where mm-hmm. I'd been for 14 years. In thinking about, as I was walking, I was passing some other, you know, sort of local wealth management offices that are decent size. You know, and I'm looking at their offices thinking, someday mm-hmm. I'm going to have an office, you know, here in Winter Park with 20 employees or whatever. Look, maybe we'll be national.
Right.
Right. And then it kind of hit me. And I feel like this was, you know, the Lord, the Holy Spirit, whatever, that. Yeah, it may happen. This will happen, but it may not happen in my lifetime. It might be my kids or their kids mm-hmm. that see that through. And so stewardship to me is having a clear enough, compelling vision of something that excites you, that you get to be part of, that, you know, you may not see fully realized, right? Planting the seeds for the tree that, you know, eventually provides shade for a whole lot of people, but I was just the ones to put them in the ground. And for me, that's building or being part of a community, because I think, frankly, what you've done with Common Good Capital and what you're doing with this podcast is in that spirit. I think sometimes there's a desire on my part to build a community. And I realized I don't need to build a community. I just need to be part of a community of people who are like-minded in their desire to align resources with values and make a difference in a meaningful way that's cool. And we may not get to see exactly what that looks like, and that's totally fine.
Which this idea of time and not be able to see it, that's really a foreign concept in today's world where we see money, entrepreneurs, at least on TV, you know, they go from the garage to, oh my gosh, they're now worth $5 billion.
Yeah.
Which is not crazy. The norm, but that's what we hear. So
yeah,
I'm anxious to hear this one because obviously coming from an immigrant family, I'm assuming there wasn't a lot of money there early on, and yet you make money probably as a musician, and now you're around money. When did you realize the power of capital, however you define that,
yeah.
and maybe what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So I think my favorite form of capital is human capital. I would really define as our ability to deploy our time and energy. Because if you think about it, when we're young, we really, unless you've been born into a family of significant means, we don't really start with financial capital or physical capital or any of those kinds of things. So we take our human capital and we convert it, mm-hmm. right? And then in my world, once you take a client to whatever point they want to be financially independent, it's really saying, okay, we've built up enough of these other forms of capital that they can sustain whatever it is that you've, you know, you desire to sustain. I would say for me, again, the forms of currency, if you will, were hard work, discipline, focus, commitment. And that hasn't really changed. I think the qualities that are most interesting to me are curiosity and work ethic. Because I believe that if you have those two things, and ideally if you're kind. I think we both know people who are successful who have curiosity and work ethic, but they're not the right. nicest people, right? So I think ideally success is combining those three qualities, a desire to humble yourself and put others before yourself, right? I think the neat thing about my parents and how they shaped the way I think I look at things and behave is that both of my parents are service-oriented people. You know, both of my parents were musicians, but my mom was really a performer who just loved to serve people. Whereas my dad, I mean, he'll admit it. He loves the stage. And mm-hmm. and so do I, you know, on a certain level. And so I think it's informed the way we operate and how we think about things. But yeah, I think ultimately capital for me is how do you take your resources? And I think we're in this interesting time because where my career went, I guess, from one to the next is yep. we're in this season where we really value, let's say, logarithmic growth
yep.
versus linear one-to-one growth, right? And so everything about capital is scale and, oh, can I get a 2X or a 3X or a 5X return? And what if it's just a 1X return? You know, is what's going to move the needle? And so I think that's why, you know, here I am now in a world where, you know, I want to have 75, 80 clients and take really good care of them. That's joy for me.
Have you started to think about integrating people's values, not just on the legacy side, but actually in the investment process?
Absolutely. And it's really cool to see how much the landscape has changed in the last 20 years. When I first came into the profession, you know, there were a few socially responsible right. investment funds and the general tone of that was, yeah, and they kind of you were sacrificing having values yep. for performance. Now, I mean, I think the Wall Street Journal just printed their, you know, like whatever top good management index or whatever that thing is, you know, but it's wonderful to see that we're in a place where stewardship and responsibility, whether that's environmental, social, whatever,
sure.
right? These things actually lead to better outcomes. Intuitively, yep. they should make a difference. I think this is a very exciting time. And it's definitely one of the things I like about being independent is it puts me in a position to talk about those things with people, those kinds of things with people. And again, what's aligned with their interests? And can we find opportunities that are a win-win?
All right, we're going to flip this thing around and we're going to shut this thing down. But is there a song, whether it be your own or, you know, one that the band played or just one that you listen to that resonates deeply with you?
Oh gosh.
I know I didn't prep you.
Yeah,
on this
is
one.
This is where we have to bring James in, right? I'm a huge Tom Petty fan. I mean, I love so much music. It would be so hard for me to pick one song, but.
So this does not have to be your
yeah,
most.
Yeah,
just,
yeah,
just
yeah.
Something.
No, one of my favorites though is Tom Petty's You Don't Know How It Feels to Be Me. And it's just because it's just good. It's just a good song. It's simple. It's got a great groove. There's a lot. I mean, it sort of exemplifies to me just a great song. Yeah, it's got a great melody and a great feel, and it's definitely how I aspired to play at times as best as I could. Yeah, that would probably be one of my favorites.
My old man was born to rob. He's still trying to beat the clock. Think of me what you will. I've got a little place to feel. So let's get to the point. Let's roll.
Well, Giddy, we really appreciate this dialogue. And for those of you who hopefully someday will get to meet you, we could have gone 20 layers deeper. It was awesome to just hear more about your life and who you are. And so I appreciate you opening up to us and being vulnerable. So don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Comma Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.